This is study number 44 in the first and the first in a series of sub-studies under the major study Soteriology, what the Bible teaches about salvation. Our sub-series is the litmus of lapsarianism. So let's start with a little chemistry, some simple chemistry this morning. Just enjoy, there won't be a quiz on this. And you can see that I have here on the table two containers with liquids. I know what's in each one. If you smell them, you could probably tell something about the liquids. One has been treated with a chemical, and one is plain tap water that I obtained a few minutes ago. Litmus paper is a treated paper that is used to detect the presence of something that is acid or a base. An example of an acid is vinegar or grapefruit. An example of a base is ammonia or baking soda. I have put something in the water in one of these that in itself does not cause something to be acid or base, but it produces something that does change the water so that it is more alkaline, a base. Alkaline versus acid. Now, I was trying to obtain litmus paper, which goes all the way back to the 1300s. Someone discovered that you could tell the presence of an acid or a base by treating paper. And historically, the treatment is from chemicals found in lichen from a plant. Very simple approach, treating paper with lichen in order to make it capable of telling whether something is more acidic or more alkaline, more base. Now, I could not obtain litmus paper, but I found something that will do the same thing. It is actually a pool water test kit, but in this test kit, which does three things, is the ability to determine whether the pool water is more acidic or more alkaline. So I have two test strips here, and I'm going to put them into one in each jar. And you can see that these test strips, can you see the color from pale yellow to orange and yellow on the bottom? All right? Everybody see? All right? In the back? I'm going to put this in one of these jars. And again, I'm emphasizing that you cannot tell the difference. I happen to know which is which. In fact, I initially made my chemically added solution last night in a glass of water. And Joy said to me, you better not leave that on the counter because you don't want to accidentally drink that thinking that it's okay. So one of these, if I drank it, I'd notice right away that there was something wrong with it. I don't know if it would make me sick or not. But one of these has a teaspoon of chlorine in it. A teaspoon of chlorine in less than a cup or about a cup of water. So I'm going to put this in. Let's try this one first to see what it reveals about this water that we can't see. All right, this is a test. And we're going to be concerned about the middle color here. And this, as you may know, this kind of test kit has colors on the bottle that you match the patch on. Okay, you match the patch to. Right? So you ready for this? Let's see what happens. Well, the one we're concerned about didn't change color very much. It's orange. Can you see that it's orange? Right? And it is about, on the scale describing relative alkalinity for a base or acidity is called the pH scale. And on the pH scale, this is about 7. It's in between 6.8 and 7 here, okay? So it is pretty much neutral. Right? Now let's take a look at the other one. You ready for the other one? Let's see what happens here. And watch the jar. You'll see an instant change. Bingo. All right? Now, the one at the top is telling me I have a huge amount of chlorine in here. I mean, this one, the purple one at the top, right? The one in the middle is way up on the pH scale. This scale here goes to 8.4 on the jar, and this is, and it's a red. This is moving toward purple. Right? I don't know if you can see that. The one in the middle is almost purple. And the longer it sits, the more purple it will get. So which one is plain water? This one, right? You can safely drink this, right? This one is strongly chlorine, and it's much more alkaline. Not the chlorine itself creates alkalinity, but it creates another chemical that does make the water more alkaline. So I guess I wouldn't do very well managing a pool, but I think the illustration helps us to see something you can't see can be revealed by some tests. So now we turn to our study, the litmus of Lapsarianism. Now you know what litmus is, but we'll talk about what Lapsarianism is and the relation of litmus testing to that. So first of all, what is Lapsarianism? What is Lapsarianism? Lapsarianism is not a doctrine such as election, redemption, justification. It is a tool that provides a test bed for clarifying, comparing, and testing assumptions, conclusions, and theological positions concerning God's purposes for salvation and his relation to human beings. We can think of Lapsarianism as a kind of theological litmus test. Just as a specially treated piece of paper, or in our case, a piece of plastic, reveals the presence of something that is acidic or alkaline, Lapsarianism helps to reveal the differences in theological positions and conclusions. It's a test to reveal things that we might not otherwise be able to see. Lapsarianism can be defined as a study of the logical steps in God's mind before creation with regard to his plan for humanity. The term Lapsarianism, the lapse part, is based on the Latin word lapsus, which is a noun that means fall. Not spring, summer, fall, but falling down. Lapsarianism is a set of explanations formulated by Calvinists and has to do with the fall in Genesis 3. So while there is only one plan of God, sometimes called his decree, there are also subparts, sometimes called decrees, too. Lapsarianism is a term that is used particularly with reference to the main points of God's plan. Those points dealing with his purposes in salvation, his acts, and the acts of human beings that result from his acts. In our study of the plan of God, we're justified in talking about and envisioning logical relationships in God's mind. However, when we speak of logical relationships or steps or sequences, We must remember that God never learns anything, and that everything is present to God at once and always has been. Nothing is ever new to God, and nothing in Him is contingent or dependent on anything outside of Himself, such as might occur in space or time, or things that human beings do. Since He is free to do whatever He wishes. So He is absolutely uncontingent. Nothing in Him depends on anything else. When we speak of a step in God's mind, a logical step, or something being a consequence of something else, we do not mean that God's thinking grows or changes. We have trouble understanding this, of course, because that's not the way our minds work, and we are limited. The use of the word lapsarian is based on the relative positions, as if they were in a list, of two things: election and the fall, as logical steps in God's plan, with election being the focal point, as opposed to the fall. So the question is, does election occur before or after the fall in God's logical relationships in His plan? In other words, which needed to be in place before the other in God's plan? Remembering, nothing in God, in His mind, unfolds in space and in time, right? Everything present to Him at once, and we'll talk about God's logic in just a moment. But in terms of logical sequences, which needed to come first? Election and then the fall, God's choosing some to be saved, and then the fall? Or was it the order of fall first? God planned for, or, as some would say, permitted the fall, and then He chose some to be saved. When we identify the positions of election and the fall in various views of God's plan, we have a powerful tool for evaluating overall theological systems. It's a kind of litmus test, as it were, or a pool chemical test, as we were doing this morning, but that was showing still the same thing as litmus paper would do. Theologians have used Latin words to describe the relative positions of these two elements in God's plan. They've used the word supra, which means in a sequence something comes before something else, or ante, all Latin terms, before, or infra, which means after in a sequence, or sub, which also means after. So we'll see terms supra, meaning something comes before something else, or sub, something comes after something else. A theological position that places election before the fall, election first, then the fall, in God's logical steps, is said to be supra. Election comes first in the logical sequence. And so a supra lapsarian is someone who holds that election preceded the fall. That is, before the supralapsarian means before the fall. Put election before the fall in the logical steps in God's mind. A view that places election after the fall would be infra or sub. So we have the terms infralapsarian after the fall. Put election after the fall in your analyzing the relationship of election and the fall, or sub-lapsarian, after the fall. So we can have any number of logical steps in God's plan, but the key distinguishing feature is the relative positions of election and the fall. So here's a sequence where we put election in a position above, before, supra, the fall. So you could have step one, that God in God's logical plan, step two, or part one, part two, and then election, for example, and then another feature of his plan, another feature of his plan, and then the fall. Of course, these things are carried out in space and time. So we see them as time-related. But in the mind of God, they are logical steps. So here's a sequence that puts election after the fall. Fall election, that means election is sub or infra the fall. So you could have step one where God does something, and step two where in his plan is another item, and then the fall, and then another item, and then election, and you could have other things that are part of God's, and you do have other things that are part of God's plan. But here, election comes after the fall. So election, which is our key point, is sub or infra, using Latin words, the fall. So we'll come back to these key terms a little later, but since we've spoken about the logic in God's mind, it's necessary to say some things about logic. And we talked about the issue of the meaning and place of logic in biblical studies in the previous study, Definite Atonement, but let's review it again since we're involved with attempting to describe the logic of God's work in salvation. Definition of logic could simply be how people should think when they want to think or reason well. So we carry out logic, sometimes bad logic. We don't reason well. Sometimes, hopefully, good logic. We communicate with each other better when we use good logic. As a field of study, logic involves the analysis of internal inconsistencies in argumentation, presenting the case. Involves accuracy and honesty with regard to facts and drawing valid conclusions from information. People who study the field of logic have arrived at many principles and practices that adhere to the standard of reasoning well. Logic is not something that the Christian should be afraid of. Every human being who thinks and communicates does reasoning. The question is whether or not it is done well. We use good logic when we say, for example, and this is called a syllogism. It's a series of three statements, all connected. We use good logic when we say, for example, if it is raining and I am standing outside, I will get wet. So it is raining. I am standing outside, therefore I will get wet. Or if John rides a bicycle on the streets, and all people who ride bicycles on the streets have to look out for cars, then we conclude, we reason well, using good logic, that John should look out for cars. Logic in the Western world, which as a field of study is traceable to the ancient Greeks, makes certain assumptions that other systems of reasoning do not necessarily make. For example, Western logic assumes that two opposite pieces of data cannot be true at the same time, both of them be true in the same way and in the same circumstances. So if I say John is a man, and then say John is not a man, they cannot be both be true. I think you would agree with that, correct? John is a man, and John's not a man. Wait a minute, something's wrong, right? This is an example of the law of contradiction. Some people call it non-contradiction. So John can't be a man and not a man at the same time in the same way. Some ways of reasoning in Asia, for instance, allow for the simultaneous existence of contradictory statements. John could be a man and not a man at the same time under those systems. In theology, mysticism is a school of thinking and practice that allows the simultaneous existence of contradictions, and it violates accepted Western logic. Since we're dealing with God's logical activity and the steps in his planning for the universe and salvation, remembering again that all things are present to God at once, and he never learns anything, and he never changes anything, and nothing is ever new to him, and he is not dependent on time, things unfolding in time. It's all there at once in God. Because of this, it's important to understand that logic or reasoning, the logic or reasoning that God uses is the same that we use. So speaking about the validity of logical analysis for the Christian in studying the Bible, God's use of logic, and the fact that God's logic or reasoning corresponds to ours, here's what Gordon Clark says. Now, one of the reasons that Clark spends time on this, aside from being one of the great philosophers, student of history of philosophy, and logicians and theologians, he was extremely good at many things. Now with the Lord, one of the reasons that he emphasizes this correctly, and it is important, was very important in his life, because he was accused of using logic instead of the Bible, and also accused of claiming that our logic is the same as God's. And we can know the same things that God does if he wants us, if he tells us them, if he says, if he communicates them. There are things about God that we can't know, maybe eternally never know. But if God communicates something to us, we can understand the same information that he is understanding. So here's Gordon Clark. It's strange that anyone who thinks he is a Christian should deprecate logic. Such a person does not, of course, intend to deprecate the mind of God, but he thinks that logic in man is sinful, even more sinful than other parts of man's fallen nature. This, however, makes no sense. The law of contradiction cannot be sinful. Quite the contrary, it is our violations of the law of contradiction that are sinful. Yet the strictures which some devotional writers place on merely human logic are amazing. Can such pious stupidity really mean that a syllogism that is valid for us is invalid for God? So take John and riding a bicycle. If John rides a bicycle on the streets and all people who ride bicycles on the streets have to look out for cars, then John has to look out for cars. That's true, isn't it? Is that true also for God? Clark says, absolutely. That's important. So can such pious stupidity really mean that a syllogism that is valid for us is invalid for God? If 2 plus 2 is 4 in our arithmetic, does God have a different arithmetic in which 2 and 2 makes 3, or perhaps 5? And by the way, the statement that I just read, quite the contrary, says Clark, it's our violations of the law of contradiction that are sinful. We have more and more Christians today exemplifying this with regard to their understanding of the Bible and their theology, will say, for example, it is wrong for me to commit this act. But that is compartmentalized, and in what they actually do, they will say, it is all right for me to commit this act. Their belief system, which happens to be right, does not come over to their practice, and in effect, really, they have a different belief system for what they do. And that violates the law of contradiction. I must not do that. I can do that. Right? So there's a direct violation. Clark goes on, of course, the scripture says that God's thoughts are not our thoughts and his ways are not our ways. But is it good exegesis to say that this means his logic, his arithmetic, his truth, are not ours. And I want to say at this point that in the 1940s, Gordon Clark, who taught at the University of Pennsylvania, head of the philosophy department at Penn, and was prominent in Presbyterian circles in the Philadelphia area, Pennsylvania area, he was attacked by those who said, no, we cannot, our thoughts do not correspond to God's thoughts. Right? His arithmetic and truth are not ours. We can never know what God is really thinking. Right? But then, of course, in my view and Clark's view, that would mean that the Bible doesn't correspond. He's given us something, but it doesn't correspond to what he actually thinks. And then what would we have to go on? Nothing. So Clark says, if this were so, what would the consequences be? And by the way, he was attacked for supposedly being rationalistic, using his mind, as opposed to those who were saying, this is in the 1940s, those who were saying, no, we cannot, our mind is limited because we cannot understand what God's logic is or how God thinks. Clark says, he has enabled us to think the way, same way he thinks. And what he says is true, we can perceive to be true also. So what would the consequences be? If it would mean that not only our additions and subtractions are all wrong, but also that all our thoughts in history as well as in arithmetic are all wrong. If, for example, we think that David was king of Israel and God's thoughts are not ours, then it follows that God does not think that David was king of Israel. David, in God's mind, was perhaps prime minister of Babylon. To avoid this irrationalism, which of course is a denial of the divine image, and he is saying we are made in the image and likeness of God, and at the heart of that is thinking logically, logic. We must insist that truth is the same for God and man. Naturally, we may not know the truth about some matters. Again, God doesn't tell us everything that he knows. But if we know anything at all, what we must know must be identical to what God knows. God knows all truth. And unless we know something that God knows, our ideas are untrue. Think about that. It has very far-reaching implications. God knows all truth, and unless we know something that God knows, our ideas are untrue. It is absolutely essential, therefore, to insist that there is an area of coincidence between God's mind and our mind. We're not gods. God is a separate being. We're created by God. But his mind and our mind, Clark is saying, operate the same way. And ours operates as he does because he made it that way, made our minds that way. To repeat, even if it seems wearisome, logic is fixed, universal, necessary, and irreplaceable. Irrationality contradicts the biblical teaching from beginning to end. Irrationality meaning, I cannot think the way God uses. Different meanings of the word, but for our purposes, let's leave it at that. Irrationality being, I can't think the way God thinks. Clark says, yes, we think the way God thinks. He's infinite, we're not, but the logic is the same. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is not insane. God is a rational being, the architecture of whose mind is logic. Now that's a very, in some ways, very startling statement. But I want you to think about that on your own. God's, the architecture of God's mind is logic. The same thing that people of goodwill attempt to determine in asking the question, how should we reason if we want to reason well? How should we argue if we want to argue well? Lapsarianism can be viewed as, first of all, putting oneself in God's place for the purpose of understanding what he is doing, Or two, thinking about the logical relationships that exist in the mind of God concerning his plan for the universe. So we can know how God's mind works. He has communicated information to us. It is true. And we can think in logical ways, the same as God's logic, because he's given us that ability. And so we want to think about the logical relationships in his plan, insofar as Scripture has told us about them. His plan has always existed and has existed as a whole from all eternity. God's plan has been there. And we want to think about Ephesians 1:11, the plan of the one who works all things according to the counsel of his will. But we can assume that since the theological systems we are comparing can be analyzed in terms of human logic, the same kind of logical formulations existed or exist in the mind of God. In other words, the question of what comes first logically, election or the fall? We can look into that because we have the equipment with minds that can work logically that mirror what God's mind is like. In our everyday thinking, as well as in our actions, we have to depend on the logic of cause and effect and the relations between things. Some things cause other things to happen or to come into being. In turn, some things are dependent on other things. For example, we conclude that an apple exists because there was an apple tree that previously existed. The apple tree is antecedent to and produces the apple. The apple is there as a consequence of what that apple tree did. The two previous sentences about the apple tree show that in our minds we process and depend on logical relationships, causes, dependencies, and so on. If a friend appears at my front door, for example, I conclude, using logic, that he walked or drove or rode a bike to my house. Wouldn't that be reasonable? He walked to my house, drove, rode a bike. If, however, it is raining heavily and he is soaking wet, I'm likely to conclude what? That he didn't drive to my house, right? The cause of his being wet is significant exposure to precipitation, which would be more likely to occur if he walked or rode a bike. But if I had a very, very long driveway and a gate at the end and he had to park down there and it was raining heavily and he had to walk the full length of my driveway and was soaking wet because of that, well, then I would conclude that either he walked the whole distance from his place or wherever he was, or he rode a bike, or he drove a car and parked and had to walk a long way up my driveway, and so on. So these are the kinds of things that we do all the time in our reasoning, and this is in the area of one thing being the result of something else. He's wet. Why is he wet? Well, he was in the rain for a long time. And why was he in the rain for a long time? Well, we just talked about that. When we plan a course of action, we take into account logical and perhaps physical relationships. So if I want to buy a quart of milk at a convenience store, I know that what has to happen? I know that I must first get myself to the store, and before that I have to plan steps to leave my house, make sure I have my wallet in my pocket, which is sometimes not the case, and decide what kind of milk I want before I leave, and so on. I first lay out these steps in my mind, and then I carry them out physically in space and time. So my plan to get a quart of milk has a number of steps that I lay out in my mind, and I don't say, I drive to the store, oh, and then I come back to get my wallet, Or I drive to the store, even have my wallet, but I haven't decided what kind of milk I need or asked someone in the house what kind of milk they prefer, and so on. God's plan, his decree with its subparts, must have the same kinds of logical relations, except that the pieces of his overall plan do not unfold in his mind in a time sequence. Everything is present to him at once. So when I think about going to the Wawa to get a quart of milk, my thoughts occur in time sequence, and I'm also thinking about carrying them out in time sequence, and that may be important too. How long do I have to do that? To go get the milk, to drive there and so on. When God carries out his plan in space and time, we can see the outworking of the logical relations in his mind. The plan in God's mind and the plan unfolding in space and time are two different things, although they're connected. It's not difficult to conceive of likely points in God's plan. For example, God knows that if he creates human beings, it would be nice for them to have a place to live. So these are two connected things. If I create human beings, are they going to be suspended in space, or do I give them a garden to live in? If sinners are to be rescued, there must be a means of rescuing them. And if they need to be rescued, there must have been something prior to that that they need to be rescued from. If God intends for human beings to communicate with them, he has to first give them the ability to interact with him. He has to give them communication ability. Creation and a place for people to live, humans to live, are logically connected then. So, which must come first, by the way? Creation or a place to live? Well, in God's plan, in God's mind, he wants to create human beings, but he knows that before that plan unfolds in space and time, he's got to have a place for them to live, right? And then, of course, he's got to have reasons for creating them and constant the things that flow from his creating them. All of these things are connected. For creation to happen, Genesis 1, there must be a place for Genesis 2, creating human beings, 1 and 2, there must be a place for humans to live, right? So if he creates Adam and Eve, God says, oh, I forgot where I'm going to put them. Right? No, part of his plan connected with them is a place for them to live. And if human beings are going to communicate with God, he has to have built the communication ability into them, and so on. We'll stop here and continue with the litmus of Lapsarianism next time. Thank you.